Chapter 9. We're going to finish with the story of Noah, and then we're going to look at the prophecy of Noah that Jesus said, as in the days of Noah. We're going to look at the end of the age and the end of the world. And then we will begin introducing Abram, who will become Abraham, and the great miracles that God worked through this man in the future of the world. And we'll finish with chapter 9 and 10 and 11. God blessed Noah and his sons and said unto them, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. He is now bringing the blessings to Noah and his family, which comes on to you now, these blessings. They were given to Adam and Eve. They were told to multiply, replenish, and subdue the earth. I hold an article here in my hand, and it's a follow-up article following up from the first research that was done that the USA Today had reported months and months earlier, a couple years earlier, of a man that we all know, Robert Ballard, who discovered the Titanic and was a very important financier and scientist that looked for the Titanic and discovered its location and put the project together. Ballard has gone out, and he has now discovered the remains of what they think is about a 7,000-year-old civilization that existed on the Turkish coast off the Black Sea before the region was inundated by a flood that archaeologists say might be the one associated with the biblical story of Noah's Ark. I'll just give you, the pre-flood civilization resided around a large freshwater lake in a river valley. I'll give you a synopsis of the article. Basically, and there's photographs here of their cameras that have gone down in 331 feet of water and have found a town. And they have found things that have been bored, that somebody had to have an awl or a drill to drill into the rocks. The formation of together, definitely a large village. And they feel that in this valley there are many, many more. And here's the astounding thing. Is that Ballard realizes, as the scientist on his expedition, that this is all covered with salt water, so the ocean as you know it today, but then there's silt over it, which would be the bottom of the ocean, but as they uncovered it, they found that these things are in fresh water. So there was a huge lake, they know, in that part of the world, but how did salt water get on top of fresh water unless some huge flood came and covered everything with salt water? And listen to what it says in the USA Today, one of the number one selling worldwide newspapers. Experts say the discovery will force scholars to rewrite the history of ancient civilizations. As in the days of Noah. Amazing when you stop and think of that. That they now have photographs of civilization underneath salt water that was covered with the layer of the ocean, but underneath that there was life before the ocean covered it in an area that was inland. And they have found both salt water and freshwater clams and seashells in the location around where the old lake used to be. So it tells us that there was life here, and then it got covered with a huge flood. That wasn't just a local flood that covered the whole world. That's from USA Today. That's not from the Bible, but it is saying man may have to rewrite all of history because the Bible is right. Now, do you think man's going to allow that to happen? Well, the devil's not going to allow it to happen, that's for sure. So the Lord's just going to take us off, and he'll just let him figure that one up, and he'll cover us. So God blessed Noah and his sons and told them to be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be upon every beast of the earth, and upon every fowl of the air, upon all that moves upon the earth, upon all the fishes of the sea, into your hand they are delivered. For every moving thing that lives shall be meat for you, even as the green herb which I have given you all things. But flesh with the life thereof, which is the blood thereof, shall you not eat. Otherwise, if it's alive, you can't just eat a living animal. It can't be a cannibal. If it has blood in it, you can't eat it. It has to have all of its blood drained. But notice the fear of every animal, the birds, everything in the field, the wild animals that we would call them, fowl of the air. When you go in to a field and there's a little varmint running around, he doesn't stop to talk to you. He scoots. Even a rattlesnake or a poisonous snake, if you're coming into the area and they know it, they want to get away from you. Elk, deer, grizzly bears. A grizzly bear could be aggressive if he hasn't eaten for a while and you get aggressive with him. But they can smell you for miles away, and they take off for the higher ground to get away from man. There is an innate fear that God has put in animals, because animals now know that you can eat them. And they don't want you to get them and eat them. So it's in them. If they see a man, get out of here. The only ones that don't do this, McDonald's owns most of them. They're dumb. They're called cows. And we eat them, right? So this is where God says, now you don't have to just be a vegetarian. You can eat meat also. But that's why when you see a bunch of little birds eating something down on a park bench where a guy just left his lunch, and you start walking up, that whole flock will just get out of there. They're afraid of you. God put it in them. And then he says, surely your blood of your lives will I require. You're responsible for your life. And I'll require your blood at the hand of somebody else, he's going to say. I require at the hand of every beast will I require it. At the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Otherwise, God's saying, I'll hold you responsible. And if you'd go to Romans chapter 13, you'd realize that government has taken this responsibility. That God is saying capital punishment. If you shed another man's blood, then you have the responsibility that that man dies for shedding somebody else's blood. Whoso sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. And you, be fruitful, multiply, bring forth abundantly in the earth, multiply therein. And God spoke unto Noah and to his sons with him, saying, and I, behold, I establish my covenant with you and with your seed after you. So now comes a covenant, and we want to take a look at this covenant. It's about a fourfold covenant that he's going to make here. I establish my covenant with you and your seed after you, and with every living creature that is with you, of the fowl, the cattle, every beast of the earth with you, from all that go out of the ark to every beast of the earth. I will establish my covenant with you. Neither shall all flesh be cut off any more by the waters of a flood. Neither shall there any here any more be a flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the token of the covenant which I make between me and you and every living creature that is with you. For perpetual generations, this goes on forever. I do set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be a token of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come to pass when I bring a cloud over the earth that the rainbow, as we call it, shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And the water shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. And the bow shall be in the cloud, and I'll look upon it, that I may remember the everlasting covenant between God and every living creature of all flesh that is upon the earth. And God said unto Noah, this is the token of the covenant which I have established between me and all flesh that is on the earth, the token or the sign. And God has given this. The word covenant means to cut. I don't know if you know that or not, but it's referring to the cutting of the sacrifices, which was a definite part of making an agreement. And though God had made a covenant or a promise to Adam and Eve, they could multiply and subdue the earth, he also brought his judgment. And through Noah, God made an agreement with all mankind. And its terms are found right here, and they stand today. And that's what he meant, through every perpetual generation. The basis of the covenant was the shed blood of the sacrifice in chapter 8, verses 20, 21, and 22. Just as the basis of the new covenant, Jesus said, behold, this cup, he says, is the cup of the new covenant, the New Testament. This is my blood that is shed for you for the remission of sins. And this is the New Testament. The old covenant was the sacrifice of these animals, just as the basis is for Jesus Christ now. The terms of the covenant are threefold. Number one, God will destroy mankind with a flood of waters. It will not. Number two, man may eat animal flesh, but not blood. Number three, there is fear and terror between man and beast. Number four, human beings are responsible for human government, seen in the principle of capital punishment. And chapter 13 of Romans, verses 1 through 5, gives you a very clear picture of that. In verse 18, the sons of Noah that went forth from the ark were not Larry, Curly, and Moe. They were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And Ham is the father of Canaan. So you may want to underline that, because you're going to see Canaan's going to have a difficult time the rest of his life, and just a few verses away. These are the three sons of Noah, and of them was the whole earth spread. And Noah began to be a husbandman, and he planted a vineyard, and he drank of the wine, and he was drunken, and he was uncovered or naked in his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. Shem and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both their shoulders and went backwards. And they covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backward, and they saw not their father's nakedness. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him. And so he said, "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren." And he said, "Blessed be the Lord God of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he shall dwell in the tents of Shem, and Canaan shall be his servant." And Noah lived after the flood 350 more years. And all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Now, as interesting as many questions were brought up last Saturday night about the mathematics of the ages, what about the math teacher that was sitting here? Are you here tonight? He didn't come back. I guess we scared him away. He wanted to know about Lamech and Methuselah since their ages were so old. They both died prior to the flood. Looking over it again this week, I saw again about Methuselah. Methuselah died the year of the flood. We don't know that he died the day of the flood, but he died the year of the flood, and he was a righteous guy. And here we see that these three sons are the focus now. And we're going to look at these sons. You got the whole three branches that come from Noah that make up the entire human race today. And where they land is laid out here in the scriptures, and who their relatives are laid out in the scriptures. What we don't know from the scriptures is why there are Asiatic-looking people, there are Oriental people, there are white people, there are brown people, there are black people. It doesn't say because their genes or anything. For all we know, when Adam and Eve had children, each kid came out a different color. We don't know. But we're going to see that they migrate to the certain parts of the earth, and from them come the Chinese and the Arabs and the Jews and the Africans. And you can see, and the white people, you can see that they start coming from the different areas of the world. Why and how, the Bible doesn't say. I've heard all sorts of things of the people who lived in Africa to help themselves from the sun. Their pigments of their skin got darker, and as the hundreds of years went by, the DNA and the genes and chromosomes made that up. We don't know. It's not clear about that, but it is clear of where these sons sent the families of the earth. So we have this covenant that is made. Now, Noah is found drunk. This isn't just some young kid going out and having a bottle of wine. This is a 600-year-old man. Okay, so he's not just some kid just out, you know, with a little bottle of Ripple from 7-Eleven or Circle K. This guy was old enough to know what he's doing. I have read several commentaries. Some say it's because he's never had wine before. He didn't know that grapes could be fermented, because before the flood, grapes didn't ferment. Well, we don't know that for a fact. But we do know that he drank too much. And this is a great key, because Ephesians 5 says, "Be not drunk with wine wherein is excess, but be rather being filled continually with the Holy Spirit." So he took it to an excess. Now, there's some things here in the language that just in our King James Bibles don't let us see the whole picture here. But when we see that this guy got drunk, some say that the Hebrew text suggests that Noah knew he was getting drunk, and he deliberately uncovered himself for whatever reason they don't know. A robe was also used culturally, that it would be used also to cover the man when he would sleep. But it was thrown back in such a way that either it was too hot out, we don't know, or he just got so drunk he didn't care that he was naked. The point is that he was naked and exposed. And you remember the first thing that Adam and Eve did when they saw they were naked was cover themselves up. So topless bars and nudie dancers and pornography and all that, that is perverted from what would be a normal person that would say, "I want to cover my body, because that's the natural thing to do. The unnatural thing is to expose yourself to people. So Howard Stern is an unnatural man, and he makes millions of dollars a year after through using perversion in using females to be perverted and to have them exposed. And so when you see these things that are accepted by society, it shows you how corrupt society is. And Noah lost his modesty. And this is what happens when alcohol gets into your system and you do not think correctly. And this is what happened, is that he was not thinking correctly and he had lost. And you could say, "Oh, well, look at all the pressure he's under. All those smelly cows and elephants that were in that ark and all those days he was there. And just wondering if he's going to make it in 120 years of ridicule. He had a right to go get drunk." No. And you may lean that way too. Well, I have a right to get drunk because I can smoke a joint. You've got to get the pressure off me. God doesn't want me under pressure. The only way you get under pressure is you put yourself into it and you let it come to you. That's the only way stress builds up, is you allow it to build up. You're in charge of your life. And that isn't the answer, that you should go have a happy hour after work. The answer isn't that. The answer is that you should turn to God. For he's the Prince of Peace, Jesus Christ. He gives you the peace that passes all understanding. What you're saying is that I can find peace somewhere else than from God. And that is the nature of human sin, all the way from Cain going to the land of Nod. He's going to do it on his own. So he gets drunk here, and it's a sad tragedy. But the son comes by in verse 22. Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren. Two things in verse 22, extremely important. The term saw isn't that he just was walking by dad's tent and glanced in and said, oh, the old man's drunk. You guys come here and see it. Uh-uh. It is a term that he was willingly staring at the nakedness of his father. And secondly, gladly is what the original language actually says. Gladly went and told his brethren. So he looked in there and gazed upon him, and it was kind of sick that he'd take longer than just a scan and then run and say, come on, we got to cover up the old man. No, he gladly, in putting his father's authority down and showing disrespect, went to the other two brothers. That's very important to see, because sin is still in the human race, even though the blessing of God is right here. And these three boys seem so good up to this point. And look what happens. You can see the contrast of the other brothers. And Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren. And the two other brothers, Shem and Japheth, took a garment, laid it upon their shoulders. If you can get that picture, they put it on their shoulders and they agreed and thought it over how they're going to do this. And they walked backwards into the tent, didn't even look at their father's nakedness. They showed respect. Yes, he has gone a little too far. He's drunk. He's naked. But that's between our father and God. And so we're going to do the respectful thing. So now you can see a splintering here of the families. And something very sad is going to happen here when this old man wakes up with his hangover. And some excuse Noah, saying that he didn't know it was fermented, but nevertheless he did get drunk. But the Bible does not excuse sin from any saint. So this is the third failure on the earth, resulting in the flood. And now he had a shameful drunk to deal with. To make matters worse, he has a son of a righteous man that tells with delight of the weakness of the father. And that is a sign of weakness. Proverbs tells us that a talebearer of secrets is not to be trusted. I don't like people to bring me rumors and be talebearers. I don't like it. The devil usually uses it. If you're a person prone to go around telling everybody secrets, you're like a fiery dart in the hand of the devil trying to hurt other people's reputations or the people you're telling for whatever reason. So what we see here is that you're just not excused from your sins. And Noah wakes up and learns who it is. Noah woke from his wine, verse 24, and knew what his younger son had done unto him, or his youngest son. And he says, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. Noah learned that Ham had done this and pronounced this famous curse. This is actually the third curse of the Bible. Chapter 3 of Genesis, verse 14 through 19, and chapter 4, verse 11, are the first two curses, and this is the third curse of the Bible. And the fact that he curses Canaan, notice that he curses Canaan, the son of Ham, suggests that the boy might have been involved in the sin along with his father, and that he was there with his dad, and his dad was a bad role model for him. And so the younger son, Canaan, just sort of joked with his dad, and his dad made fun of grandpa instead of saying, let's cover grandpa's sin. You know, the Bible says love covers a multitude of sin. And you want to be a person that's prone to, hey, let's don't spread a rumor like that. Have you talked to these people? Go talk to them yourself. Let's cover them up. Let's cover a person's nakedness when they're exposed. Let's don't think the worst of them. Let's help them and defend them. And the proverb says that that's a wise person and the blessed person from God that takes that attitude. So it's likely that the boy was with his dad, with Ham, when he sees the nakedness of old Noah. So God is going to punish the sins of both the father and the son. And Canaan and all of his brethren. And you remember, Canaan were the Canaanites. And that's where Joshua went in to Canaan to destroy all those people. And they became the servants of the Shemites. The Shemites are the Semites, the Jews. And the Canaanites became the servants of servants. And so this curse carries on. And it's still there today. So they are cursed. And he was really uptight, the old man, when he woke up and saw this problem. The Jews went in there and did exactly what God said they would do through this old man's curse. And then it says, cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants. And he said, blessed be the Lord of Shem. And this would be the Jews, the father of the Jews. Canaan will be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth. He's going to prosper. And he shall dwell in the tents of Shem. Otherwise, he will live in the midst of the Jews. And Canaan shall be his servant. And Noah lived after the flood 350 years. So we see that Noah lived into maybe 50 to 60 years of Abraham's life. Methuselah carried over from Adam, and Adam's story was passed on and passed on to the guy in the boat. The guy gets off the boat, and he carries it until Abraham comes on the scene. So Abraham is very close to the story of creation and understands what's going on. All the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Chapter 10. So Noah blessed the Jews. He gave the Canaanites to them as servants. He promised that the Gentiles, who would be Japheth, would be spread abroad. And that's where we come from, the Gentiles, from Japheth. But spiritually speaking, they would dwell in the Jewish tents. And in Romans 9 through 11, Paul the Apostle speaks about the Gentiles being grafted in to make the Jews jealous, to turn them towards righteousness. And so as a Gentile, I thank God that he's willing to deal with them by letting me, you know, get into the tents of Shem. And that's a figure of speech there. Now, in chapter 10, we see the sons of Japheth, the sons of Ham, and the sons of Shem. And it's going to just basically tell us in this chapter of 32 verses, the families of the world, the 30 original races come from Ham. So you may want to make a note of that. 30 races come from Ham. And these only four were immediate descendants: the Ethiopians, the Egyptians, the Libyans, and the Canaanites. And also the people of Babylon were part of one of these races, although the center of Ham's culture appears to have been in northern Africa, that he went that way. It's evident that the early Hamites spread in various directions. In Genesis, you'll see here, chapter 10, verse 18 through 10, we have the words Babel and the words Shinar. And that gives us sufficient proof that this section of Scripture has to do with Babylon. So the source comes from Ham. The sons of Japheth have 14 nations that originally come from him. And we discover their ancient seats around the Caspian and the Black Seas, as well as in the lands bordering the north shore of the Mediterranean Sea. And then from the coastlands, the people from Japheth spread to Europe, northern, western, southern Asia, and then on to the United States, as we call it, or to the Americas. And it's interesting to note that some of their names, like Gomer, that we'll see here, they lived in Ukraine. And the Medes and Javans, who were the Madii, and Javan was the Greeks, gave some indication where these people migrated. And the Syrian inscriptions have also identified that the Bible is actually true. And then the sons of Shem, we have the history and the growth of development of early migration, the Semitic race, and then its division in the various families. So we'll look at that. Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, Japheth. And unto them were sons born after the flood. The sons of Japheth were Gomer and Guber and from Mayberry. No, Gomer and Magog and Madai and Javan and Tubal and Meshech and Tyrus. And the sons of Gomer had Ashkenaz, Riphath, and Togomar. And I want you to underline Gomar, if you would. I'd like you to underline Magog in verse 2, Gomar in verse 2, Tubal in verse 2, and Meshech in verse 2. And we'll go back to that. The sons of Javan, Elisha and Tarshish, underline Tarshish, Kittim and Dodim. But these were the isles of the Gentiles divided into their lands, every one after his tongue, after his families, and their nations. So now the Gentiles come from this area. Then the sons of Ham, Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. And the sons of Cush were Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, Sabtigna, and the sons of Rama were Sheba and Dedan. And Cush, and circle this in the person's Bible sitting on your left side, verse 8 and 9, circle it. And Cush begat Nimrod. And he began to be a mighty one in the earth, and he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. So circle 8 and 9, and we'll come back to that. And the person's Bible on your left side. The beginning of his kingdom, so speaking of Nimrod, was Babel. So now we know he's the starter of the Babylonian Empire. Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. And out of that land went from Asher and builded Nineveh and the city of Rehoboth and Calah. Now Nineveh is where Jonah went to, and Jonah did not want to go, you remember. And that's why he was thrown off that ship, and that big fish, the whale or whatever you want to call him, ate him up. The Ninevites were ungodly people. And God was going to spare them and give them an opportunity. But no, Jonah was so prejudiced against them and so angry and despiteful of these wicked people. He said, no. God, you'll just forgive them if I go and preach. I don't want them to be forgiven. And so that's the same Nineveh. Resen, between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. Mizraim begat Ludim, Ananim, Mim, Lehabim, and Naphtuhim. And Naphrusim and Casluhim, out of whom came the Philistines, Philistim, Kaphtorim, and then Canaan, the grandson who brought the curse, begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. And you remember the city of Sidon. Jesus went to Sidon, which is up there in Lebanon. And the Jebusite and the Amorite, the Uptite and the Outasite. Now, Jebusite and the Amorite and the Girgashite. And the Jebusites were in the area of Jerusalem when King David was around. And the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkite, the Sinite, the Arvadite, the Zemarite, the Hamathite, and afterwards were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. So they spread them out in that area of the world. Now you may want to circle the word Girgashite in the person's Bible on your right-hand side. I've been looking after the Girgashites for about 20 years now. You can find nothing anywhere concerning the Girgashites. They're mentioned a few times in the Bible, and they are not to be found in history anywhere. The Girgashites are an amazing group of people. I have tried to research it and look for it, and even in the 80s when I found that, it came to me in a prophecy one night in Brago Springs in the 1970s when about 8 of us pastors were together praying for the church. The Girgashites, the Lord prophesied and said, do not become like the Girgashites. I had no idea what a Girgashite was. And I looked in the Bible, and there they were, the Girgashites. And I looked for them. So every time I went through the Old Testament and found the Girgashites, about 4 to 6 times, I think. And the only thing I can get from that prophecy is, don't become like the Girgashites means nobody knows anything about them. There are a lot of great things that happen, and then all of a sudden they fade away, and nobody knows anything about them. Be a fruit bearer with your life. Don't just be a skyrocket on the 4th of July that everybody goes, oh! And then it's gone, and you're off to work on the 5th, and you say, oh, it's a nice fireworks, but you can't remember what it looked like, you know? So you don't want to be like the Girgashites. So the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon as you come to Gerar and Gaza. So the Gaza Strip is a major area of conflict today, and that goes on with the curse from Noah's son and grandson. As you go to Sodom and Gomorrah down to the south, those are both wiped out. Admah, Zeboam, even unto Lesha. These are the sons of Ham. Now it tells us what Ham does. After their families, after their tongues, in their countries, and in their nations. Unto Shem, also the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Japheth, the older, even to him were children born. The children of Shem were Elam. You've heard of the Elamites. Asher, Arphaxad, and Lud and Aram. And this is the guy that invented the fax machine, Arphaxad. And Lud and Aram. And the children of Aram were Uz, Hul, Gether, and Mash. And Arphaxad begat Salah, and Salah begat Eber. And unto Eber were born 2 sons. The name of one was Peleg, not Peg-leg, but Peleg. For in his days the earth was divided. Underline that in your own Bible. Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided. His brother's name was Joktan. And Joktan, begat Almodad. And Shaleph and Hazarmar, Beth, Jerusalem, and the rest of these guys all came along. These were the sons of, verse 29, of Joktan, and their dwelling was from Mesha, as you go to Sephar, a mountain of the east. These are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, after their nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations and their nations, and by these were the nations divided into the earth after the flood. Now, this is probably one of the most remarkable pieces of literature on the planet. It gives us the entire beginning of the human race after the flood and shows how everybody got to where they are today. And it is a phenomenal piece that is not only found in the Bible, but has later been found on many archaeological digs when it names the family tribes that migrated in the east. So this is a phenomenal thing, a little boring to the east, to the American culture that doesn't like hard things to read. I ask you to look at a couple of things, very important for us to look at. The great cities that spoke of here, the founder of the monarch bears the name Nimrod of the Babylonian Empire. Its site is the land of Shinar. Its ethnic character is Cushite or Ethiopian. Nimrod's the descendant of Cush. The four great cities of Shinar or Babylon are Babel, Erech, Akkad, Kalna. And research of Mesopotamia has revealed this nation as the earliest seat of power and civilization in all of Western Asia. This was the first big place that masses of people gathered together, other than when Cain went out of the garden, we saw in our last message, and he began to build a city and named it Enoch after his son. There are also sites in Mesopotamia where Nimrod's name is a sign that would indicate that he was a ruler over the Cushite kingdom. And this is kind of important. So I want to back up here and look at two things. First of all, I ask you in verse 2 to underline Magog, Javan, Tubal, Meshach, and then Gomer and Togarmah. Hold your finger or marker here in Genesis chapter 10 and go with me to Ezekiel, the prophet Ezekiel, chapter 38. Ezekiel chapter 38. Chapter 37 deals with a bunch of dried bones in a valley. God asks Ezekiel, what do you see? And he says, I see a bunch of dry bones. And he said, prophesy unto those bones. Those bones get up and the hip bone's connected to the knee bone and everything starts working out great and moving. Well, he's saying that's the end of the world. And at the end of the world, my people, Israel, will come back together and join themselves together as a full body. You are all alive when Israel became a nation. 1948, you weren't all born then, but you're all alive in this time. And we have seen the bones of Ezekiel 37 come together. Now, one of the things that will happen at the end of the world is that there's going to be an invasion of Israel. Zechariah said that in the last days, Jerusalem would be a stumbling block to all the nations. That would mean, literally, the United Nations, as we know it today, would turn against, including the United States, against Jerusalem. It has to. We will turn against Israel. The Arabs call it the 51st state of the Union. The people over there, they say that if it weren't for the billions of dollars that we give to Israel, the Arabs would destroy them. But it's just a small thing about the size of Rhode Island or Connecticut, just a small landmass, a sliver of a landmass, just a few million people. And there are a lot of problems over there, but God's got his hand on it. Look at Ezekiel 38, of one of the major things that will happen, and this could happen in our lifetime. It could happen after the rapture of the church. The word of the Lord came unto me, son of man, set your face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshach, and Tubal, and prophesy against him. These are all the landmass areas of Genesis chapter 10. These are part of the cursed people. And say, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against you, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshach and Tubal. And I will turn you back and put hooks into your jaws, and I will bring you forth, all your army, horses, horsemen, all of them that are clothed with all sorts of armor, even a great company with bucklers and shield, all of them handling swords. Persia, which is Iran, which is an enemy of Israel, Ethiopia, Libya, which is definitely an enemy of Israel, all of them with shield and helmet. So North African states, Gomer, and I ask you to underline that, and all of his bands, the house of Togarmah of the land quarters and all of his bands, many people with thee. But be thou prepared, and prepare for yourself, you and your company that are assembled unto you, and be thou a guard unto them. After many days you shall be visited in the latter years, you shall come into the land that is brought back from the sword. And it is gathered out of many people, so the Jews coming from Russia, from South America, North America, all over the world, is happening right now, this verse right here. And is brought back from the sword, is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste. But it is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them. You're going to descend and come like a storm. You shall be like a cloud to cover the land, you and all your bands and many people with you. You, thus saith the Lord God, It shall come to pass that at the same time shall things come into your mind, and you shall think an evil thought. You shall say, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. Otherwise, there's peace in Israel. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell safely, all of them dwelling without walls, having neither bars nor gates around their houses anymore, to take a spoil, to take a prey, to turn thine hand upon the desolate places that are now inhabited, and upon the people that are gathered out of the nations, which have gotten cattle, goods, and that dwell in the midst of the land. This is the people that are living in Israel today, ladies and gentlemen. They have taken all the swamps and all the places that were disease-ridden in the north, and they have made them the most fertile producing land in the whole planet. Up there in the Golan Heights, where they're growing the vineyards, down in the valley of the Golan, and the just off of the Lebanese border, coming south down to the Sea of Galilee, it is so rich and so fertile. And the kibbutzim that are there, the people that are working the kibbutzes, are just making it just beautiful. You're going to take a spoil. Sheba and Dedan, there's two more. And the merchants of Tarshish, with all the young lions there, shall say unto you, are you come to take a spoil? Have you gathered your company to take a prey? Only two countries are going to speak out against this huge invasion. Are you coming to carry away silver and gold, to take away cattle and goods, to take a great spoil? Therefore, son of man, prophesy unto Gog. Gog literally means chief prince or head. He's the leader. And until the czars, after the czars left Russia, until Mikhail Gorbachev came on the scene, there was never a Gog. He became the single speaker. It wasn't just the Communist Party. But it says in verse 2, set your face against him in the land of Magog. Magog is the area where these sons of Noah's grandchildren migrated, and it is the area of Russia, the Soviet Union. And today, the Soviet Union is splintered, and the area of Magog is predominantly Muslim, Islamic, revolutionary countries that have nuclear weapons and have sold some to their allies that are mentioned here and are being questioned because they now have submarines. The Iranians have submarines now that could go and torpedo the oil ships, the tankers. And there is some question of some of the nuclear armament that is missing from these Muslim states once the disintegration happened of the Soviet Union. So Magog is out here, and the chief prince of Meshech. Meshech is in the northern west part of Magog, and it's where a group of people that came, and they were named there in Genesis 10, came and migrated called the Muscovies. And they had a capital for the Muscovies called Meshech. And those that lived in Meshech were called the Muscovites. Meshech later became called Moscow. And so God is being very specific that at the end of the world, there's going to be an atheistic, anti-God area of the world that has influence into the Middle East and into Africa, and is going to get all those people that are against Israel to come together, and that is the Soviet Union. Nimrod was the grandson of Ham through Cush, and his name means rebel. Very important. Rebel. He was a mighty hunter. He's a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty tyrant, actually, in the sight of God. And he was the first dictator on the earth. And the word hunter does not mean or refer to the hunting of animals, but that word actually refers to the hunting of men. This man was a murderer, a killer. He was a warrior. He was a mighty strategist. And he was wicked and evil. He's the founder of the Babylonian Empire, where we get our way of doing business in capitalism. Comes from the Babylonian. Astrology, stargazing, prognostication comes from the Babylonians. And it comes back right here to this guy that Satan used, like the Antichrist of the book of Revelation, to spread the bitterness and hatred of Cain from the land of Nod, from the city of Enoch, after the flood, that those seeds were there, that Ham would still be bitter and turn against his father, and then he would spur these ugly seeds of sin and rebellion. And Nimrod was one of rebellion. And even it was written, he means that it's been seen somewhere else, as Nimrod the mighty hunter before God. Now the sad thing, if you want to buy Alexander Hislop's book, it's titled The Two Babylons. Babylon in this Bible symbolizes rebellion against God and confusion in religion. But we see Babylon opposing the people of God throughout the Bible, culminating in the the great whore of Babylon, Revelation chapter 17 and 18. And here's the sad story about this mighty wicked guy. The Babylonian history and legend tells us that he and his family came up with this religion that would be a worldwide religion. His mother, Semiramis, would be the mother of God, and he would be God. And that she would be a virgin, and the story was is that he was born of Semiramis, his mother being a virgin. And that she was to be worshipped, and they did artwork and icons. And this religion spread throughout the world, and it's still around the world today. And it was always Semiramis holding baby Nimrod with a halo over his head and a halo over her head. They had a priesthood and a hierarchy in the priesthood. And they had these little booths that the people of Babylon would come and talk to the priest, that he would be in the booth, and they would confess what they'd been doing in the neighborhoods and their sins, basically. And they were called the priesthood. And the sad thing was is it was also an intelligence gathering center, because these priests were part of a cultic anti-God deal, and they knew how to control the neighborhoods because of these priests, quote-unquote, that knew what everybody was involved in, and they could understand what was coming down and what was happening. Well, to perpetuate the religion, they picked a date, which was December 25th, would be the day that Nimrod had been born of the virgin Semiramis, and that she, being the mother of God, is now called the Son of God. And to celebrate December 25th in their culture, they would go to the forest and chop a tree down and cover it with tinsel and bring it into the house and nail it to the floor. And it was a great expansion of business in the slower months of the winter, that they would give gifts, and so the economy would be built up and carry them through the winter months. And then the solstice would be taking place after the first of the year, and there'd be more holidays that were there. But when spring came forward, as things were going into lull, their religion said that Nimrod, the hunter, was out in the woods, and a wild beast jumped him and killed him. And they looked for him. They couldn't find him. But 3 days later, he miraculously came back from the dead and came out of the woods and said, "Here I am," and they worshipped him. And they were so into fertility and sex, Ashtoreth, under several different names in that region of the world, Ashtart, Ashtoreth, Isis in the Egyptian religion, the sexual goddess of fertility, different names were given to her. They worshipped the tree at the December 25th holiday because when the pine cone would drop or the seed would fall from the tree, it would perpetuate a tree and another tree would grow. But at the spring resurrection of Nimrod, they worshipped it by rabbits, because a rabbit was a sign of perpetual life, of being very fertile and multiplying very quickly, and of painting eggs and coloring eggs, because the eggs were a sign of fertility and new birth. And so those religion little holidays brought over to the Roman Empire, and the Roman Empire disintegrating because of homosexuality and because of incest in the upper echelons and because of just complete insanity that was going on. As they're disintegrating, they realize the enemy is not without. There's no army that's going to march against them. It's this Christian movement that's within, and they began murdering the Christians in the arenas. And they took the Babylonian religion and brought the priesthood in and declared under Constantine and his mother, who was a weirdo, they declared that the Roman Empire, and if you're a Roman citizen, you will be a Christian by fact of being born into this empire. And so he was baptized on his deathbed to say that I am a Christian. It's very doubtful that he was a Christian, but a great manipulator. And he brought in Saturnalia, which was the Roman version of worshiping the Babylonian gods. And they would fill the arenas in the Rome area, and they would bring the Christians ultimately into those arenas to be murdered, and the people just turned against the Christian community. And that's why the tunnels were built underneath the city. And Christians meant secretly. And that's where the sign of the fish came from. That if you were a Christian and you didn't want anybody to know because they would kill you or a mob would gang you, you would just draw in the dirt or with something on a you know, some dust or even a piece of papyrus or something, you'd draw the sign of a fish, and that would let you know that I'm a believer. I'm following Jesus. And then there was an ichthus, which was the fish with the eye, X-O-Y-E, I-O-X-O-Y-E, which literally meant Jesus Christ, Son of God. And they would put that inside the fish, and you would know. So this religion carried over to the Romans carried it into the Christian community, and those that were enemies of the state of the body of Christ, from 1 Corinthians, as I shared with you two messages ago, that Corinthians said that Satan appears as an angel of light. It's no wonder he does that. His ministers appear as ministers of unrighteousness. So they took this unrighteous religion, merged it with the Christian religion, and called it Christian, universal Christian religion. So that's where Nimrod comes in. He's a bad dude. And his religion is still being perpetuated around the world. Verse 32, these are the lands, the families of the sons of Noah after their generations and in their nations. And by these were the nations divided into in the earth after the flood. Now we'll close here in just a moment. The whole earth was of one language and one speech. A problem in this passage appears connected with chapter 10, because at the beginning it tells us, at this time, the whole earth was one speech and one language. But in chapter 10, it divided the nations according to peoples, tongues, territories, nations. And that occurs three times, but not always in the same order. But verse 1 through 9 explains the arrangement in chapter 10, how it came about. Genesis doesn't always come up in chronological order to arrange the material thematically. And so there's the chronological order in chapter 10. But in chapter 11, he's telling you in the period here when these nations were out there, everybody started out in one language and one speech. It came to pass as they journeyed from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Go over to Iraq, look at the vast deserts in that plain, and you'll see Shinar. So the whole earth was of one language. And they said one to another, go to, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and slime had they for mortar. And they said, go, let us build a city and a tower whose top may reach unto heaven. And let us make us a name. There's a big danger whenever you're trying to make a name for yourself. Lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. I got to make a name for myself, lest I don't end up where I want to be, basically. But they don't want to be scattered again. And just what they didn't want is what God gave them. And that's an interesting thought in itself. You try to do it on your own, you're going to get what you fear the most, probably. But they not only want a city, they now want a tower that will reach up to heaven. The Zoroasters say this is the first place that they got up to do their astrology. Others, would say, no, this was a launching pad for space vehicles. And I don't know, some of those guys. But let us build a city and a tower. And so they're very into themselves. We're going to have a huge empire and communication center here. And we're going to rule the world from this spot. And the Lord came down to see the city. Only time we see that the Lord's down now, since he's closed the door at the ark. And the tower, which the children of men builded. Not the children of God, but the children of men. These aren't the Sethites. See, these are the Canaanites. The Lord said, behold, the people is one. They have all one language. And this they begin to do. And now today, ladies and gentlemen, the earth is one in your lifetime, just again. Now nothing will be restrained from them which they have imagined to do. It's called the World Wide Web. We're now all speaking one language. All the binary codes start with the one number 666, just like the Mark of the Beast in the Book of Revelation. And we've built this tower of communication that we can talk to anybody on the planet or even outer space right now, or on the moon if we wanted to. We've built that tower, and we're now going to control it all ourselves. That's what cloning and all this stuff works together. Go to, let us go down, God says. And there confound their language. Notice, let us, plural. Same as the very first word we studied. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The word God I showed you was Elohim, plural. It's deity, but Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. They're still on the throne. They're still in charge. Let us go down there, confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Couldn't you imagine you're standing there and you're all speaking one language, and all of a sudden you ask the guy next to you to hand you a brick, go, you don't know what? He's what? And then another guy starts talking like Wookiee the Ewok, and then sort of like Star Wars, all those guys in that tavern scene, the nose in there. Everybody just sort of gets weird on each other, and just, what is this all about? I mean, what happened to you? And I guess what you would do is gravitate towards the people that spoke something like you. Okay. And then if they walked like an Egyptian, talked like an Egyptian, you walked and talked like one. So you became one. So he says, scatter them abroad. Therefore is the name of it called Babel. So when you hear somebody babbling, that's it. Because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth. And thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. These are the generations of Shem. This is where the Jews came from. Shem was 100 years old and got Arphaxad 2 years after the flood. So 2 years later, his wife has a baby. And the rest of this chapter here, verse 11 through 26, is basically the genealogy of Shem. It is a vertical genealogy. It's designed to show legitimate ancestry. And this type was often used in the ancient world to establish the authenticity of a king or a dynasty. Some of the others that we have here in the Old Testament are not vertical where you could follow them, like in Matthew, where you can see the vertical trail to Joseph and then to Mary to Jesus. They're sort of sideways and they're spread out. That they had these different groups and it goes more linear. But this is vertical. So here's all the people that we have. Now, verse 19 and 18, Peleg lived 30 years and begat Reuel. Now, Peleg, I had you underlined him, not Peleg, but in verse 25 of chapter 9, for in the days was the earth divided. Two things here, two schools of thought. One, the nations were divided, but two, Peleg means the word division, separation by division. And many believe this is when what we would call the continental drift happened. You ever take South America on a map and you look at the hump on Africa and you say, hey, if you could slide South America right there under that hump, it would fit together. Hey, you could take North America and bring it over here and hook it up here to this part of the world. And you could take these places. And this is when they think that the great cataclysmic events were happening. And not just Noah's flood, but there were tremendous things happening on the earth. Some believe there were five major epics that happened. Job says that there were huge tsunamis that took Leviathan. It was this huge sea serpent or creature that was so powerful that men's spears and knives and swords could not penetrate the scales that were over him. And that the scales were so tight that when he closed them up, that they would seal and he could go underwater. And he was airtight. And yet there was this huge creature that breathed fire out of his nostrils. But Leviathan was made meat for those that lived in the desert. Otherwise, some catastrophic tsunami type thing picks up the ocean and throws it inland a long, long ways. So this is where they believe that the earth had these earthquakes going on, and all of a sudden the continents started ripping and shredding, and we are where we are today. So that's where Peleg comes in. His name means division. The earth was divided at that time. Now, the other thing I wanted to point out before you go home was this thought about this genealogy. Unlike the genealogy in chapter 5, the list in verse 10 through 26 does not tally the total numbers of each person, nor does it close each section with the words, and he died. Genesis 5, verse 1 through chapter 6, verse 8, stresses death before the flood. But in this genealogy, verses 10 through 26 stresses life and expansion through longevity, even though longevity was declining for the human race. So it's opportunity for the future humans to live and to make the best of their world. So you can follow this genealogy yourself. And we'll go down here to verse 24. And Nahor, Serug lived 30 years and begat Nahor. Serug lived after he begat Nahor 200 years and begat sons and daughters. And Nahor lived 9 and 20 years and begat Terah. And Nahor lived after he begat Terah 119 years, and he begat sons and daughters, and Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. These are the generations of Terah. Terah begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran begat Lot. And Haran died before his father, Terah, in the land of his nativity, in Ur of the Chaldees. And Abraham and Nahor took them wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. The name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and the father of Iscah. But Sarai was barren. She had no child. And this is where God is going to work the miracle to bring the Messiah, through a barren woman. And Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. And they went forth with them from Ur of the Chaldees to go into the land of Canaan. And they came unto Haran and dwelt there, which is close to Jerusalem. But we'll set the stage that Noah and his group have passed by. And now Abram is going to come. And Father Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob will be the next stories that we'll look at as we go through the scriptures.